section.
Yeah, I just want to call your attention to this again, Sunday, 3 to 5 p.m. It's a great opportunity, especially if you're in this class, to experience some speakers who will visit these issues in a pretty profound way. So take note of that if you can make it. It'll be a good event. As for the writing and the majors applications, I'm collecting them now, so please get those to me or as soon as you can here or right after lecture. I've got section right after lecture, so the way that we'll do the writing and the majors section is I'll post it outside of 306 Furno by 4 o'clock today. And I'll also email around the results of who's in the section and what time it's going to be. So that's the way we'll deal with that. So please get these into me now, and then we'll post the results outside of 306.
Thank you, Greg.
Just a couple of brief announcements. Is this coming through okay, Greg?
You can hear me okay, right?
Yeah.
The way the course packets work, let me just remind you again, is they don't like to print too many of them because it raises the price if then they're not sold. So if you try to get the course packet at the campus store and they're out, let them know at the desk and they guarantee that within 24 to 48 hours they will have a copy for you there. And that is a way of keeping the cost of them much lower than it would be otherwise. And also, I encourage you to buy your books fairly soon because if we're short on any of them, they'll have to order some more. We ordered enough, but what sometimes happens is some of the books look interesting to people and they pick them up, people who aren't in the course, I think. And so we have somewhat of a disadvantage there. I'd also like to ask a favor of you. My wife, Carol, has a very, very severely suppressed immune system. She has advanced multiple sclerosis, and we deliberately suppress it. If any of you knows that you have a bad cold or sore throat or infection, I would very, very much appreciate it if you would keep just a little distance from me when you talk. Because when I bring stuff home to her, it's very, very serious because it tends to pick up the multiple sclerosis again. And also in my discussion section, if you know you've got some kind of bug or something, don't sit right next to me because it becomes very serious for her if I bring infections home to her. That would be a huge favor. Okay, we will have a... Yes?
Oh, this is under the
test,
but I have something about the study sheets.
Yes.
Were the same questions are we supposed to write on it?
Okay, that was my next point. Thank you very much. It was right at the top of my list here. I wanted to say just a few words more about the synopses. The questions will vary somewhat from week to week, and sometimes you'll have some options to choose one of two, or I think in a couple cases, maybe even one of three to respond to. And many of these are designed to draw out your opinions on things, where you stand, what you're thinking. But I don't want just opinions. I want you, so far as possible, to substantiate your views with good reasons, either from the readings, from your experience, from other things that you've heard or read or learned at Cornell. So even when we ask, what do you think of so-and-so, I don't want you, in a sense, just to emote or share your feelings. I would like to know what you think. But as far as possible, give the best reasons you can. And that would apply also to the exams in the course, because although the judgments that we make in the realm of ethics and in the realm of environmental policy are seldom as clear-cut as they are, say, in experimental chemistry, on the other hand, it's not just a matter of totally undisciplined feeling and opinion. We usually, in making important decisions, try to give good reasons why this course of action is better than this course of action. So throughout the course, whether it's on exams, term paper, or the synopsis questions,
try to be honest with yourself. I do want to know what you think about these issues, but then wherever possible, try to defend your views, and also don't hesitate on the synopsis sometimes to say, you know, I don't really know. I thought a lot about this, and the arguments on this side of the question are fairly convincing, but on the other hand, they are on this side too. And there's no particular virtue in making up your mind prematurely on some of these issues when you really may not have a settled conviction that makes really good sense to you. In general, keep the synopses to one typed page. Occasionally, if you really get inspired, you can go over that, but have some mercy on those who grade them. We do try to give you a lot of feedback on them. And we do take these fairly seriously. We don't want you just to type them off in 10 minutes or so, because if they're really, really sloppy, we don't much care for that. And it also makes the TA feel like he's wasting his time if you're very careless with your spelling and grammar and thinking to spend much of his time responding to it. If you spend a good deal of time and write them carefully, we will also take them quite seriously and respond to them. Any questions that you have on the synopses or textbooks or any of the protocol? We do start sections this week and will every week thereafter. As I noted, if you're not able to make it to section, we do expect you to email your TA, and generally you are required to be there. Greg?
The only other thing I'd add to that is one-page single space and not one-page double space. So that gives you a little bit more space to make an argument or recover the point. And as for the question of the discussion questions and the study questions that are below, those are not questions that you need to respond to in the synopses. Those are either things that we might touch on in section, or that would be a very good question to look at in terms of studying for the exam. If you've taken a close look at all those discussion questions and study questions and have a good sense of an answer to each of them, you'll probably do very well in the exam because they cover a lot of the things that are in the reading that are worth pressing.
Good. Those are simply to help you study and learn. You, as Greg said, you're not expected to respond to those. I'd like to touch on a number of things this morning. I wanted to take just a few minutes to suggest what is going on in the Sachs book in terms of what to look for. One of the problems that we face in the humanities, and I hinted at this in the last lecture, is that it's not always obvious to students that the methods of the humanities are very, very different from, say, the methods in physics or experimental chemistry. Or, to take an even more extreme case, say, in geometry or some particular area of math. You don't generally, at the end of a book like this, put QED and have an absolutely clear-cut conviction the author was right, and so on. What happens in a book like this, and this will be true in quite a few of the things we read this semester, is much more like what happens in a court of law. You have witnesses who say, this is how I saw what happened, this is what I know. Sometimes you bring in expert witnesses who know a lot about chemistry or psychology or whatever it may be. And there's a kind of cumulative effect of the argument. What Sachs does here, for those of you who have already read it, he quotes some of the great naturalists, people like Thoreau and John Muir and Joseph Wood Crutch and Olmsted and others, people who have thought a lot or who have had a great deal of experience with nature and some of the ways we relate to nature. And he also quotes people who thought about fishing and a number of nature activities. And as you read this, you probably won't come to a firm conviction, yes, of course, he's exactly right, I agree with everything he says. I certainly don't agree with everything he says, and yet I think this is a very important and very readable book. Just one example, he has a discussion where he's talking about raft trips down the Grand Canyon. I'm responsible for cooking at home and getting the meals and so on when my wife's caregiver is not there, and she's not there that often. And I can well imagine that if I went on a rafting trip down the Grand Canyon, it would be a great luxury to have someone else take care of the food. I would very much like the extra time to be able to go off and sit quietly in one of the side canyons or just observe nature and meditate and maybe read a little, whatever, and not be worried about provisions and food and clean up and so on. People differ on issues like that quite a bit. Sometimes I think Sachs pushes his argument a little far, sometimes not far enough. But that is much more typical of what happens methodologically in the humanities. In some ways, in the humanities, reading material like this, and this will be even clearer on the reading Second Nature by Michael Pollan, our reading for next week. What typically happens, it's really almost more like getting to know a friend, making someone's acquaintance. And, you know, when you're getting to know someone, you don't start out by asking for blood samples and weighing them and measuring them and learning all kinds of objective facts about them. Your approach is much more subtle. Is this someone interesting? Is it someone that I enjoy being with? Is it someone that... just a whole lot of issues like that that are much more subtle, much harder to pin down, but very real. Just like in the little experiment we did with the probe. You don't know really how the brain works that out, but we do know that when we use the probe, it's very, very useful, even though the brain is playing that kind of trick on us. Getting to know people is like that, and to some extent, getting to know a book like this and the author is like that. Now, I'm not suggesting then that it's totally subjective, just like a court of law is not totally subjective. It's more subjective in some ways, say, than an experiment in chemistry, but there are good reasons and better reasons and worse reasons and so on. And that's also why, and I think you'll see this more next week with the Poland book than with this book, some of you get impatient because you tell me, or these students have in past years, I'm sure none of you will, that why is the author so long-winded? Couldn't he have said the same thing in 20 pages rather than 150 pages? And I never quite appreciated that argument, because if you're writing an article in Nature or Science about a very specific set of experiments, brevity, conciseness is a virtue. But on the other hand, what would be the point of going to a 5-star Parisian restaurant and taking what is normally a 3-hour meal and insist on gulping it down in 20 minutes? Or what would be the point of going to a Bach cantata or an opera performance and having the music play twice as fast and everybody singing twice as fast? In the humanities, a good part of the experience is that it often has a certain leisureliness to it, just like in being with a friend. You don't want to hurry things sometimes. You want it to be leisurely. And you'll find this particularly when you read the Pollan book next week. Pollan was an editor at Harper's. He's an extraordinarily talented writer. It's just a pleasure to read that book, and I really had to work hard not to assign the whole book and just pick out some of the chapters, because I know it is a bit long. But in many of the readings, take your time, enjoy them, as you would a friendship. And that gives
time for the ideas to soak in. And that's why the readings that I assigned for the first week, the piece by myself on our need to control, and the couple short Taoist poems, are fairly important. Because what we're going to argue for in this course is not that scientific reason is bad. It's very good. It's one of the great intellectual achievements of human beings. But that we need a balance between scientific reason and other kinds of reason. And as I will argue in a later lecture in more detail, the kind of knowledge that, for instance, a mother has nursing a 2-week-old infant is a very important kind of knowledge. The kind of knowledge that a potter has as he works the clay, even though he can't articulate this, even though he couldn't give you formal algorithms or describe in detail what he's doing, that is very important knowledge. And this is why we urge you, the TAs and I, to enjoy the readings and not just see them as something to get through. So as you read Sachs, remember that it is rather like building a case in court. And he quotes these witnesses, these experts. He shares their convictions. And what usually happens in a case like that is if you generally agree with the position, he'll probably nudge you a little further in that direction. On the other hand, we assign some stuff that you probably will disagree with. I disagree with some of the things we assign. And then that will stimulate you to ask yourself, why do I disagree with what the author is saying? Are there hidden assumptions that I don't share? And what are they? And how would I address these? So that's the kind of thing we wanted to at least mention in reading the work. I decided to take just a little more time on the fact, value, knowledge theme that we looked at last time. There were a lot of questions at the end, and wanted to give you a little more time to raise some of them and to push this a little further. Let me start out with a few comments and then get comments and questions from you, and also feel free to interrupt as we go. I think probably I would have done well to spend a few moments talking about what are the apparent advantages of relativism. I was pretty hard on relativism. I think sometimes we tend to move in a direction of relativism or the whole thing, don't judge others, who am I to impose my values on others, because we have, either in our personal experience or in our knowledge of history, seen all too many people who were dead sure they were right and were not at all bashful about trying to push us in the direction they thought we ought to go. And most of us are not terribly happy about having friends like that. We are not terribly happy historically when we see figures like Stalin and Hitler and others who were pretty sure they were right and not at all bashful about pushing their beliefs and values on others. I think that that is one of the reasons relativism is attractive to us, because it seems to be a very tolerant position not to push your beliefs on others. But as we will see later in the semester, we're going to read a fairly technical piece on relativism by Alan Wood, a former Cornell philosophy professor who's now at Stanford. What we will see is that almost exactly the opposite is true. Because if your values and beliefs are always right for you, then you never can be wrong. Think about that for a moment. If I believe X and I'm right, and you say believe the opposite and you're right,
not only is it impossible to talk with each other, but in a truly relativist world, you are never wrong, because your values are right for you. I am rather what has been called in the literature a fallibilist.
A fallibilist, as over against infallible.
That is, I believe that virtually nothing I know is infallible. I'm a human being. I live in a particular historical context, a particular age, a particular time, with a particular set of genes and environmental experiences. So at a very deep level, I realize that virtually everything I claim to know may be mistaken.
I don't think it is, but I think that's a
theoretical possibility. And indeed, we've all discovered at times that we've held some beliefs very deeply and found out later that we were mistaken about them. It seems to me to be a fallibilist is a much more tenable, defensible position than to be a relativist. Because if you're a relativist, you're always right. Whatever you believe is right for you, and you're always right. But a fallibilist may hold a conviction deeply and admit the possibility that she may be wrong. And I think fallibilism is a much more defensible position, a much more workable position in a pluralist society. We see debates today, like debates over affirmative action. Very good and thoughtful people come down on both sides of that question. And interestingly, even more and more minorities, women, blacks, and others, are beginning to oppose affirmative action. Good people come down on both sides, and it seems to me the appropriate stance to take is, yes, I think this view is right, but I may be wrong. So notice the difference between fallibilism and relativism. Relativism seems more modest, it seems more tolerant, but when you really unpack it, it's not tolerant at all, because you're always right. Your values are always right for you. But a fallibilist will say, yes, I believe this rather strongly, and I'm even willing in some cases to risk my life on it, but I may be wrong.
In the realm of science or practical affairs, most of us risk our lives every day on the elevators in Bradfield or in things like that. But we have a sneaky little suspicion way back in the corner of our mind that it's at least possible that someday a cable might break or something bad happen. I know intellectually that apart from terrorist attacks in recent years, more people are killed each year in the United States by hitting deer, and maybe 50 times or 100 times more people are injured than in commercial aviation accidents. But yet, I worry a lot more when I go on an airplane than when I drive down the street. So fallibilism is a defensible position. I'm not so sure that relativism is. Just a couple more words about, is it ever right to impose our values on others? We touched on this very lightly, and my answer to that would be, it all depends. Obviously, it doesn't make much sense to go around insisting, I may have used this illustration last time, that everybody eat pistachio ice cream or avoid strawberry or whatever, but it makes a great deal of sense for society to insist and for us as individuals to support that position, that we will impose our values on others when it comes to murder and rape and theft and slander and a whole range of ideas that destroy civil society. So should we impose our values on others? Yes and no. It all depends. If a parent does not impose certain safety values on children, the children won't survive. You can't allow a one-year-old, a two-year-old to run out in front of cars. You have to be a non-relativist at that point.
The issue is not whether we impose values or not, but when and under what conditions is it appropriate.
And what is interesting to me is that even in areas where we more traditionally think of the issue as subjective, there really are good reasons you can give sometimes.
I had a PhD student, one of the most interesting students I've ever had, David Pepe, about 20 years ago. He's one of the best naturalists I've ever known. You could go out in the woods with him, and he just saw hundreds of things that I never saw. I mean, he just had his antennae out. In fact, he wrote a book on nature methodology, how to observe nature. And David was one of the better students that I had, and he was working on the theme, can you argue that certain types of nature appreciation or certain natural areas are aesthetically more attractive and more inviting than others? Can you make good arguments, for instance, that Yosemite Valley or some of the more beautiful parklands that we know are more attractive and more worthy of preservation than, say, the New Jersey Meadows? Although I think originally they would have been worthy of preservation, but they're not very pretty today. And as he wrestled with this, I suggested to him, I said, David, it was just a hunch I had, but I said, why don't you go and spend 2 or 3 weeks or a month reading the literature on wine connoisseurship. Are tastes in wine purely subjective, or is something more going on than just the individual taste? So I spent about a month reading in the wine connoisseur literature and find out that this was a very, very highly developed discipline. Many books and hundreds of articles and people writing on the subject. And there was a reasonable amount of disagreement, but there also, and this surprised him to some extent and pleased him, a huge amount of agreement as to what constitutes a better wine and a worse wine. It had to do with things like, does it leave a bad aftertaste? Is the aroma so strong that it distracts you from other things? Does it blunt your taste for certain foods that you might eat afterwards? And it went on and on. And what David discovered is, yes, there is a lot of subjectivity in an area like that, but there are also a lot of what he called regularities that most people who have anything to do with wine agree on. And of course, that's true in baseball, it's true in music, it's true in many fields that we think of as very subjective, that there are things that are quite regular. Probably not a one of us here today is pleased by the sound of a thumbnail scratching over a blackboard. That is a sound which fairly universally displeases people. Cultures have learned, and many of them perhaps not even aware of it, that a very young baby, an infant, generally likes a higher voice than a lower voice. And in almost every culture, men to some degree, and even women to some degree, but men more so, raise their voice when they talk with little tiny babies, because somehow they've discovered that that higher voice is more pleasing. Another regularity I was just fascinated with, I just learned about it from my daughter-in-law about 2 or 3 weeks ago. She'd been reading some learned treatises on the fact that it probably is not all that good for an infant and a small child to keep everything too quiet. Because now there's research that has shown fairly conclusively that in utero, it's a very noisy environment. The blood coursing through the placenta and so on, the heartbeat and everything, is really pretty noisy. And that if the baby is born and then everybody is totally quiet, that may be
difficulty. And what this research suggested, and I don't know if it's right or not, it's possible that the authors got it wrong, but it's fascinating, is that in many, many cultures, in fact, I think in every situation they looked at, they have found that when you want to quiet a baby, you go, shh, and that is much more universal than people realize. And what they're speculating is that the shh, which has an almost hypnotic effect on the baby, and they gave experimental data that in some cases it could just quiet the baby almost like a reflex action, is that they speculate that that shh is like the sound the baby experiences of the blood coursing through the placenta, and so on, all of this magnified because of the amniotic fluid, and et cetera, et cetera. So what I'm trying to suggest is that even in the realm of what we typically think of as subjective, it may not be nearly as subjective as we think. That there may be regularities in what it means to be a human being that are more constant than we think. We've just gone through, maybe are nearing the end, I'm not sure, although I think probably not, of a historical experiment with children of great significance. For about 30 or 40 years now, we have had in the United States very, very widespread no-fault divorce. And this was advertised and defended initially as being not just good for the husband and wife, but good for the children, that they would be much better off if the husband and wife weren't fighting all the time, and if they were happier, and if they parted and had new arrangements. I went through a divorce after 10 years of marriage, and my children at the time were only 3 and 5 years old. Now we find that it's not been so good for children. Almost all of the sociological data says that in general, children are better off with both a mother and a father, both parents, and that they just do a lot better on average. We're not talking about individuals, we're talking about statistical realities here, that on average, they do better in a traditional mother-father family than with a single parent. And that's why in the realm of ethics, it's very, very difficult sometimes to know how to proceed. Because in the realm of ethics, we normally don't do those kinds of experiments. I may have mentioned in the last lecture, we don't take 100 or 1,000 kids and beat the tar out of them for 10 years and compare them with 100 or 1,000 kids that we treat with tender, loving care. Thank goodness. That wouldn't be ethical. But occasionally, we get caught up in ideas like the no-fault divorce, and it is a kind of historical experiment, and then we look back on it and see that maybe it wasn't the best thing to do. The cards aren't all in, the data might still shift somewhat, but it doesn't look so good from where we stand today. Yes? Right. In both where they wanted to, where it was amicable, and so on. And there's just an incredible amount of data on this, as there also is data, and I'm going to talk about this at greater length towards the end of the semester in another context. There's a huge amount of data that children who grow up without fathers are in big trouble, generally. Not always, but on average. Unless it's a situation where the father died of a heart attack or was killed in war, in those cases, the memory of the father lives on and the idea of fatherhood. But where the father even never shows up, where he gets the woman pregnant and then just disappears, or where he divorces his wife and fails out, overall the impact on kids is very negative. And the data is just hugely clear. And the reason you tend not to hear it at places like Cornell is that the
some of the departments are so ideological, they don't want you to hear it. This is not popular data over in human ecology and so on, because ideologically it doesn't fit in with the dominant thinking that family structure is very subjective and, you know, one is as good as the other. Yes?
Is that any different for children like growing up without
a mother? I'm sorry?
Is it comparable to children growing up without a mother?
The situation, my guess is, would be hugely worse if they grew up without a mother, but unfortunately mothers don't do what fathers often do. They don't bail out nearly as often as fathers do. But we don't have that much data because it's much less common.
What about same-sex unions, like mothers?
I think that we're at the beginning of what could also be a very tragic experience. My guess is that homosexual couples adopting children is a very, very bad idea, unless there's no other alternative available. It might be better than being an orphanage or something, but my guess is as a standard operating procedure is going to be very bad for children because there's a lot of data that kids need both male and female role models, and that if you deprive the child of that, that it's hurtful for the child. This is why I have a very bad feeling when, say, some young movie star who doesn't want to get married gets artificially inseminated or gets pregnant, however, and wants to raise the child on her own, almost as a pet. I think that's incredibly unjust, because most of what we know suggests that that is to underprivilege the child from the very beginning. And I think it's just astounding that we are so, quote, tolerant of that kind of behavior that's probably very hurtful to the child. I don't want to get off on this too far right now. I wanted to point out that in the realm of ethics, we often have historical experience, but sometimes the impact of it on society is not that good. Sometimes innovation is very good. Sometimes not so good. Let me move on to a slightly different point and then leave a few minutes for comments. I also very lightly touched last time on the point that you cannot think or live or survive if you start with radical doubt. We have been often taught that it's good to doubt everything. Don't believe something unless you can prove it to be true. And the position that I will argue for, and that many philosophers argue for today, is that if you insist on radical doubt, you will die. I gave a couple illustrations. You cannot survive starting with radical doubt. I gave the illustration, I think, of the coffee mug and the student, the child learning to speak. There are many, many examples you could give. We start where we are. And where we are, as we gradually come to consciousness, is that we have learned a particular language in a particular culture at a particular time, and we have learned that certain things are right and wrong, and so on. And the position that I'm suggesting is that the rational thing to do is to accept that and then keep your mind sufficiently open that you admit the possibility that you may have been taught in a wrong way. And thus, when I ask questions like, how many of you know that gratuitous torture is wrong? It was interesting in this class because most of you either accepted that or didn't want to say you didn't know that. In my seminar yesterday, virtually everyone in the class voted sort of for a relativist position. And what I'm suggesting is don't pretend not to believe or know what you do believe and know, given the redefinition of knowledge that I'm suggesting, that knowledge is not theoretical certainty. I'm theoretically certain about almost nothing. Knowledge is a claim for which you can give good reasons, or at least that's one kind of knowledge. It's a warrantable assertion. It's a belief that you can substantiate. And that's true in science and true in morality. So when you start with a claim, like it's wrong for any human being to torture others just for no particular reason at all, there's no special virtue in claiming not to believe that to be true. And there's great danger in not accepting it as true, because radical doubt is paralyzed. So what I'm suggesting is start where you are and don't think you have to be able to prove everything you believe. Because the foundational assumptions that you make in both science and morality are not capable of simple proof. I mentioned the law of non-contradiction. Something can't be both A and non-A in the same time, manner, and place. You can't prove that without assuming it. I mentioned the regularity of law in the universe. You can't prove that the laws of physics and chemistry don't shift arbitrarily every 100 years. They might shift 10 minutes from now. You can't prove that they won't. I don't know if I mentioned it in this class. I mentioned it in the seminar. You cannot really prove that the universe is more than 10 minutes old. You can't prove that. It's quite conceivable that some weird, crazy god created the universe 10 minutes ago and just for fun put all these memories in our brains and constructed all the buildings and radioactive decay and galaxies shooting apart. This would be sort of a fun thing to do. You can't prove that didn't happen. But the point is, who would want to try? It seems so silly, both scientifically and philosophically and theologically. So we don't try to disprove it. So start where you are with those beliefs that seem rational, that seem right, and don't think you have to prove every one of them. So when someone says what Hitler did to homosexuals and Romano, the gypsies and Jews and others, is wrong, of course you believe that's wrong. Of course you believe it's wrong, and you believe it firmly enough that I think it constitutes what might rightly be called moral knowledge. Let me pause there. Am I getting through it all on this, that radical doubt is not virtuous? Starting with assent is not only virtuous, it's necessary. You have no choice. Any, help me out. Am I getting through it all? Is this, yes?
Yeah, it kind of actually relates to what he was saying with practicing and self-paternalism, that you have to trust some stuff that other people say or do, because otherwise you can't do anything. It's very simple.
Yeah, you can. Virtually everything we know is a social construct. I don't mean by that it's all subjective and false, but we know what we know because other people have taught us the language, they've taught us how to think, they've taught all kinds of facts. The average practicing chemist, she probably doesn't know over one half of 1% of what she knows through personal experience. Almost everything that she works with daily, she knows and accepts because she trusts that other people are telling the truth. And we have ways in the scientific community for excommunicating the scientist who cheats. But you have to have those ways or else the whole discipline breaks down. Yes? Nice and loud.
Does this sort of torture that you're talking about really actually exist?
Does this sort of what?
Torture? Like with no reason?
Oh, the torture? No. I mean, it might have. I think there have been people who are mentally ill and so on and tortured just for the amusement. I'm sure there are. But no, in philosophy, if somebody says there's no X or no Y or Z, to save time, the philosopher will often try to produce at least one example of X, Y, or Z, and then you have to modify the claim there's no X, Y, or Z. So instead of starting with very controversial issues where people of goodwill and very rational people disagree. Affirmative action, first trimester abortion, a whole range of social issues. I immediately give an extreme case, because if you say you never can know whether a moral claim is true or not, and I produce at least one that looks like most of us know it's true or false, then we have to modify the original statement and say, well, we can know that some moral claims are true. So that's why you will find me methodologically often giving what look like bizarre examples, because those establish the point. Now, obviously, in the realm of morality, there are all kinds of moral issues that are extremely difficult. And good people disagree. And that's partly what makes life fun. You know, that's why we are what some writers have called the chattering species. Why do we chatter all the time? Answer, we talk so much because we are the species that does not live very much by instinct, by genetic determinism. We are partly determined, obviously, by genes and instinct, but much more so than any other animal species, we live by culture. And culture is talking. Culture is art. It's music. It's trying to convince each other that one way of living is better than another. And what I'm suggesting in this class is that when that dialogue is carried on in a civil and courteous manner, when you don't force your beliefs on others, it is a humane and civilized and right thing to do to try to persuade your friends to change their mind on some issues. It's not imposing, it's just what it means to be a human being. If I have a friend who's eating some food and I've just read 6 scientific studies in Science and Nature and elsewhere that show that this particular food will kill him within 5 years, I'm not much of a friend if I don't share that with him and try to urge him to change his way of living. So we're the chattering species. We talk together, we discuss, because we're trying to find out how to live. But the position that I'm trying to defend is that that's a good thing as long as it's done in a civil and courteous and non-coercive way. It reminds me of a very, very strange policy that Cornell University has about the Student Activity Finance Commission. For years, they've said, we won't fund religious groups at Cornell, although they're fudging a little bit on it now. And the reason they won't fund them is that religious groups proselytize and they're controversial. And when I've met with the dean and others, I've said, well, what about animal rights groups? Or what about radical groups of this kind or that kind? They also do that. But then the other thing I would say is, that's what a good university is about. We ought to be civilly and courteously, politely, dialogue, talking about what we think the good life is about, how we could better treat nature, talk about the fact that animals aren't just things. They're not just resources. They also deserve respect and so on. So that rather than being a bad thing, I am honored when someone tries in a polite and civil and pleasant way to change my mind, because it shows that she has some concern for me. Does that make sense? It's all how we do it. We always ought to treat each other with respect, but that doesn't mean we ought never to disagree with each other. What a dull, boring world it would be if we never disagreed with each other or talked about interesting things like sex and politics and religion and so on. Wow, I've run out of time. That's all for today.